Hey everyone, I'm David Chalian, CNN's political director, and welcome to the CNN Political Briefing. Thursday was a historic day at the United States Supreme Court. Justices heard oral arguments in a landmark case. They considered whether former President Donald Trump should be immune from criminal charges related to his attempt to overturn the 2020 election.
Why is it, as a matter of theory, and I'm hoping you can sort of zoom way out here, that the president would not be required to follow the law when he is performing his official acts? Everyone else, there are lots of folks who have very high-powered jobs, who make a lot of consequential decisions, and they do so against the backdrop of potential criminal prosecution if they should break the law in that capacity.
I respectfully disagree with that characterization. The president absolutely does have responsibility, but the remedy for that is the question. Could he be subject to personal vulnerability, sent to prison but making a bad decision after he leaves office?
It's an argument that came under fire, but the case is still not over. Here to tell us what she makes of today's arguments and what's next in this case is Leah Lipman. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny. Leah, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, obviously, a monumental Supreme Court oral argument today, not just because it is the Trump case and his quest for total immunity as it relates to the Jack Smith prosecution of him and his activities around January 6th, but because it obviously would deal with presidents forevermore, long after Donald Trump and we all have departed this earth. So it's consequential both in the immediate and, of course, in terms of the role of the presidency. Overall, can I just get a sense of what was your, and I know it's always hard to read tea leaves in oral argument, but what was your takeaway from how you think the justices approached both Trump's attorney and Jack Smith's representative there?
I think my overall take is really twofold. One is, I think it's likely that the court is going to reject Trump's most extreme version of immunity, which, as his lawyer suggested in court, would make a former president immune for ordering the military to conduct a coup. When pressed by Justice Kagan, Trump's lawyer said, yes, it's possible a former president would be immune for that. I don't think there are a majority of justices who will endorse that position. I do, however, think there are going to be divisions within the justices about what they are going to say about how broadly the immunity extends short of Trump's version of immunity. But the second point I wanted to make is that in some ways, that aspect, the division among the justices and whether they order the Court of Appeals below and the trial court in this case to make additional findings and make additional legal determinations, that is the most important part of this case because it will determine whether there is a possibility of a pre-election trial on these election interference charges.
I am not the expert you are. That's why you're here. I'm just asking the questions. But to my layman ears, it certainly sounded to me like Chief Justice Roberts was very much in the place of remanding this to a lower court to sort some of these things you were saying. And therefore, it sounded to me we may be in the position of expecting a delay and that this Jack Smith trial happens well after the election.
I think that's right. Without Chief Justice Roberts voting in favor of a straight-up affirmance, that is just letting the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals opinion stand, it's difficult to see how there would be five votes on the court for an affirmance and just allowing the trial to proceed in light of the D.C. Circuit opinion. And the question is just what exactly the justices say and if they can actually coalesce around a rather clear legal standard for the courts below to engage. I think that whatever the legal standard is, it's pretty clear from the facts alleged in the indictment that what the special counsel alleges Donald Trump to have done falls outside any plausible or reasonable understanding of a president's official duties. But it's possible you're going to get some of the justices writing separately to say, actually, there also needs to be this determination about whether this law in particular applies to the president. And there needs to be not only a determination about the outer bounds of the president's authority, but also the president's motive. And the more and more you layer on, the harder and harder it's going to be to actually get a pre-election trial.
Right. So you alluded to several things in that answer that I do want to dig into here and sort of, because we kind of fast forwarded here to the end of this and got your take on where you think this case may be going and the implications of that. But I actually want to dig into the arguments themselves and what is actually being presented to the court today by the advocates on both sides. Now, you noted the Trump attorney was making the case for total and complete immunity. And obviously, the justices were not rallying around that. And almost immediately, it seemed to me in the oral argument, the justices were looking, okay, that's the outer bounds, and that makes no sense. But there is some sort of narrowing of a scope here to figure out what you just said, Leah, which is this division between what is an official act and what is a private act. Why, in the context of this case about immunity and presidential powers, is that delineation so important?
So part of a theory of immunity would be that a president or former president is immune and cannot be prosecuted for any actions that fall within the scope of the president's official duties. That is, if the president is just merely doing the job of the president, conducting the affairs of the executive branch, he or she cannot be prosecuted for anything within the scope of their official duties. But if the president goes outside the scope of their official duties, if the president is acting as a private citizen or, say, a candidate or campaigning, then if the president violates criminal laws in the course of that private conduct, then the president would not be entitled to immunity there. So if that is the dividing line, then that would require a court, perhaps the Supreme Court, maybe the court below, to determine, well, what actually separates official activity from private activity.
And yet, the Trump attorney was still arguing that delineation almost doesn't matter, because in their argument, any official activity, anything the president does while president, should be immune from criminal prosecution. And listen to Sonia Sotomayor actually sort of dig into that question and what that would mean at its logical conclusion.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or order someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
It could. And why? Because he's doing it for personal reasons. He's not doing it at, like President Obama is alleged to have done it, to protect the country from a terrorist. He's doing it for personal gain. And isn't that the nature of the allegations here, that he's not doing these acts in furtherance of an official responsibility? He's doing it for personal gain.
But it wasn't only the liberal justices who questioned this outer bounds theory of immunity, was it?
No, it wasn't. I think when Trump's lawyer was presenting, some of the Republican justices also evinced skepticism about Trump's version of immunity.
I was a little taken aback. I guess I shouldn't be. It's a Supreme Court oral argument, and I am sure, you know, Marbury versus Madison gets invoked on a daily basis at Supreme Court oral argument. But the Trump attorney was indeed digging into citing Marbury versus Madison, citing Ben Franklin's comments at the Constitutional Convention, where he got some pushback from the justices because some of the justices, I can't remember which one, was indicating their biggest fear, the founders, was a king with unfettered power and no restrictions whatsoever. They thought it was not perhaps the wisest thing for him to steep this into the founders' construction here.
I think that's exactly right. The courts below, as well as in other Trump-related cases, including one written by Justice Jackson when she was on the lower courts, have repeatedly affirmed the idea that under our constitutional system, there are no kings. No person is above the law, including the president, and that the president himself is not a king. And yet Trump's argument, as you've noted, would mean whenever the president does it, it's an official act and is entirely immune. That would, in effect, make the president king. But I think where there was disagreement was how to separate what acts are entitled to immunity And there, the Republican justices, at least some of them, were open to the idea of a pretty expansive version of immunity, where some of them were suggesting, well, the president's motivations just don't matter, such that it doesn't matter whether the president is attempting to defend the results or integrity of an election or overturn the results of a validly conducted election. And if they embrace that version of immunity, then that is going to collapse the distinction between protecting elections and undermining them and give presidents immunity for both.
Now, I also heard, and talk about fast forwarding here, I also heard Alito specifically expressing some skepticism about the underlying charges from Jack Smith in this case. Now, he kept saying, I don't want to speak about these charges specifically, because you can imagine, right, a world where the case United States versus Donald Trump as it relates to January 6th ends up on appeal at the Supreme Court, and they will have to figure this out. But this notion of a certain section of U.S. Code, 18371, I believe is what it is, and that it is dealing with this notion of conspiracy to defraud the United States. To my ear, Leah, I'd love to hear what you think about this. I thought Alito was giving a little bit of a preview of real skepticism around the charges Jack Smith brought here.
It was a little terrifying, and it was not just Justice Alito, but also Justice Gorsuch. So first, having Justice Alito say, I don't want to talk about the specific facts here, I don't know how you're supposed to decide a case, including a case about immunity, without engaging what the facts alleged in the indictment are. You can't determine whether a former president is entitled to immunity without analyzing what the former president is alleged to have done. But then you're right, Justice Alito went on to voice real skepticism about whether one of the statutes under which Donald Trump was charged, the conspiracy to defraud the United States, might itself be unconstitutional and just too vague and unclear to ever be enforced against anyone. And Justice Gorsuch, he criticized the other charges in this case, which are under 1512C2, which is obstructing an official proceeding. And Justice Gorsuch said, well, could these statutes be applied to a former president who leads a civil rights protest, almost equating that to what happened on January 6th. And so there you have several justices voicing real skepticism about all of the charges that Special Counsel Jack Smith has brought against Donald Trump. And that is very troubling for what might happen after this case, even after they dispose of an immunity appeal.
We're going to take a quick break. More on former President Trump's request for immunity coming up in just a moment.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. We're here with University of Michigan Law Professor Leah Littman. So there is something that keeps coming up in this argument from the Trump side. You were alluding to the hypotheticals, and boy, are there fascinating hypotheticals in this case, as it was in the lower court, that whole SEAL Team 6 can order an assassination. The argument is that the president can't be charged for anything like that, except if he has been impeached and convicted. Now, just want to remind everyone, that has never happened in the history of the country. There's never been a presidential impeachment and conviction and removal from office. So what he's hanging his hat on is something that's actually never occurred. And it seemed that from some of the justices, I think they were skeptical that that really should be part of the calculation here. But can you explain the logic behind the impeachment piece?
There isn't any real logic behind it. It kind of turns the clauses of the Constitution on their head, because the Constitution says that presidents can be impeached and then also goes on to acknowledge that they can still be subject to the laws themselves, that is, criminal prosecutions. And Trump's lawyer have said, well, what this actually means is former presidents can't be prosecuted unless they are impeached or convicted. There are all sorts of problems with that argument, aside from its logical and textual inconsistency. As Justice Barrett, among others, noted during the argument, what if the misconduct isn't discovered until after a president leaves office, and therefore the Senate and House are not in a position to impeach someone while they are in office? So that theory did not seem to get a lot of traction.
I think the retort to that from somebody was that in an earlier case, Scalia said that the court can't right every wrong, and that that was the way out of that conundrum that you said Justice Barrett put forward. It is sort of mind-bending to understand the logic around that. But I do want to explore a bit more of these hypothetical scenarios, because they seemed so crucial to the argument, because what you were describing of the test that the court is going to have to come up with, or ask the lower courts to come up with, of real determination of what is private versus official act, it seemed like the Jack Smith side of the case was arguing that official acts can be beyond just those that are actually prescribed in the Constitution as presidential power, exclusive Article II power, such as veto power. That is an exclusive Article II power, and the president can exercise that without fear of criminal prosecution. He seemed to be conceding, but that it wasn't just limited to those specified. Am I understanding that argument correctly?
That's exactly right. The special counsel acknowledged that, for example, there are some statutes that empower presidents to do things, say in conjunction with administrative agencies or as part of federal programs, and that if the president is doing something within the scope of those official duties, you know, not just prescribed by the Constitution, but also by federal law, that could also be entitled to immunity as well.
I know from a political perspective, now putting my more expert hat on here, but like, I get that delay here is a victory for Trump and getting beyond the election. But from a legal perspective, doesn't it make sense that the court might send this back to get more clarity on this delineation? I mean, in other words, I guess my question to you is, should the Supreme Court really have in its calculation a political calendar?
Not necessarily, but I think what the court often does, and I think is good institutional practice, is not having to decide more than necessary. And so they're not usually in the business of saying, well, look, down the road, 5 to 10 years from now, there might be an important question that arises that's related to us. So therefore, let's decide that in a case in which that's not actually implicated. And I think what the special counsel's office was underscoring, and that what several of the Democratic appointees took pains to repeat, is that under any definition of official act, there's just no reason to think that what is alleged in the indictment is in fact an official act. You know, the special counsel was saying, look, the inquiry is just whether there's a reasonable or plausible basis to believe that what the president did falls within the scope of the president's official duties, and that there is an objective basis to believe that the president took it for some public purpose, again, based on all of the facts that are alleged. And because that's just not true here, this case doesn't require the court to split hairs and determine, well, is it a reasonable basis? Is it a plausible basis? What exactly does the permissible versus impermissible motive have to be? And therefore, they can just say, again, we'll leave to another day what the precise scope of the legal test is. This fails no matter what it is. And that's something they've done in a bunch of cases.
I see. And now draw back the curtain for us that, unlike you, that don't get to hear every oral argument or specialize in this. I was intrigued because it seemed at a certain times in this argument that the justices were actually talking to each other rather than engaging in a colloquy with the advocates. And I just, how normal is that? And is that part of oral argument that you hear the justices actually trying to influence each other's thinking?
I think that is now a very standard part of Supreme Court practice and Supreme Court oral arguments, where you see the justices really trying to talk to one another, either by following up on other justices' questions and signaling some agreement with them, or using their questions to respond to some of the concerns that another justice raised. I think this has been happening now for several decades at the court, where the justices sometimes and maybe even often become advocates themselves who are trying to persuade one another from the bench.
And do you see, or did you see today, any of that particularly on display, or any particular justice-to-justice relationship? Because I found it was happening a lot across the ideological spectrum. It wasn't just Kagan trying to get Sotomayor onto her point kind of a thing.
No, and I think in a universe with a 6-3, Republican supermajority court, it's going to be pretty common for at least the Democratic appointees to try to be speaking to some of their Republican colleagues, because, of course, their votes are necessary in order to get to five. And so at several points, I heard Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson talking to Justice Barrett after Justice Barrett went through and read the allegations in the indictment and got Trump's lawyer to admit that several of them actually do concern private conduct. They picked up on her question several times, and there were other moments of crosstalk as well.
And my last question for you, and again, this gets back to a political calendar. As I was saying, I kind of get the argument that the court should not necessarily be considering a political calendar in its mind when it's adjudicating these constitutional matters. Obviously, that should be the supreme goal here. But what about in terms of the timing of issuing a opinion on this? I mean, I know, you know, they have until the end of June here and they get, but will it weigh on their mind in some way to try and turn this one around a little more quickly given the election year?
I have to say there are some previous indications that the court does take sort of looming deadlines into account when trying to figure out their decision. So in the Trump disqualification case arising under the 14th Amendment, for example, it seemed like they really tried to get out a decision before a big swath of primaries were happening, thinking, well, we should clarify this, get this issue resolved, you know, before the primaries actually are conducted and happen. So I don't think it is untoward or unreasonable for them to think, well, given that there is this kind of backstop, that the timing of our decision is going to affect how this legal process plays out. I don't think that is unreasonable for them to consider. It's not necessarily a political decision so much as considering how the operation of our legal system works and whether it is actually going to be a mechanism for accountability for a former president who happens to be running for election again. You're right that the term formally, kind of by tradition, ends at the end of June, and that is usually when they release all of their decisions in argued cases. I think realistically, in order for there to be even some prospect of a pre-election trial, there would have to be a decision in this case probably by the end of May. That is a very tight timeline, but that is a timeline that the court forced on itself because they held on to Trump's request to hear this case for several weeks. After they decided to hear it, they scheduled the oral argument for 2 months out rather than several weeks like they did in the Trump disqualification case. And so they really put this on themselves. And I think they have been the engine of delay. And they refused Jack Smith's request to decide the case before the Court of Appeals weighed in. And so I think they should kind of consider how the legal system is going to handle this and be able to process this, again, because they themselves contributed to the timing of this process to begin with.
Leah Lipman, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of the CNN Political Briefing. And we want to hear from you. Is there a question you'd like answered about this election cycle? Is there a guest you really want to hear from? Give us a call at 301-842-8338 or send us an email at cnnpoliticalbriefing@gmail.com. And you might just be featured on a future episode of the podcast. So don't forget to tell us your name, where you're from, how we can reach you, and if you give us permission to use the recording on the podcast. CNN Political Briefing is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Madeline Thompson and Grace Walker. Our senior producer is Haley Thomas. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is executive producer of CNN Audio. Support from Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lainey Steinhardt, Jameis Andrist, Nicole Pesseru, and Lisa Namoro. And special thanks to Katie Hinman. We'll be back with a new episode on Friday, May 3rd. Thanks so much for listening.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.